Chapter 79. Mary forced a few escaping strands of hair back into her hat and pushed it down upon her head. The way was harder, but she did not falter. The sun was hot and her legs ached, but she pushed onwards and upwards. Her temper drove her forward and seemed to supply her with reserves of stamina, but for all her angry energy she was glad when the guide chose to stop for refreshments and a short rest. Catching up with the others at last, she was relieved to sit down upon one of the rugs the guide had spread out for them, and when his son passed amongst them, offering around flasks of weak tea and small beer that were as cold as they were welcome, Mary drank as eagerly as everyone else. "We have made good time this morning," observed their guide, "and we're not far from our destination now. If you'll look in that direction, yes, ma'am, follow where I point, you cannot mistake it. That is Ashridge, that great grey shelf over there. But the walk gets harder from here. A stiffer climb than we've had so far. If any of you don't feel up to it, this is the time to turn back. My boy will take you down. He knows the way as well as I do myself." No one was much surprised when, after a huddled consultation, the exhausted Hursts volunteered that they had indeed had enough and wished to return. But Mr. Gardiner's announcement that he intended to join them was most unexpected. The gentlemen tried their best to persuade him not to give up. Their object was almost in sight. Would he not be sorry to miss it? But he was adamant.
"I fear I must sacrifice my pride to my aching legs. It pains me to admit it, but this is a climb for those younger and more agile than myself. If I go back now, there is some prospect of my taking a rod out on the lake, an occupation much better suited to a middle-aged man like myself."
He held up his hand to silence any further protestations.
"If the young ladies are prepared to continue without me, if they are happy to rely upon our estimable guide, and of course the two young men here, then I am decided. I am sorry to miss the view, but for an angler who won't see 25 again, on this occasion there can be no doubt that the fish have it."
So it was only four of the original party who followed the guide further up the twisting path, treading more slowly, yet determined to reach their goal. Sometimes, when the route allowed it, they walked alongside each other. More often they marched in single file, saying little. Everyone was hot and tired. Mary saw that Mr. Haywood had from somewhere acquired a stick, and every so often beat at the grass with it, or tossed it from hand to hand, gestures that seemed to sum up his restless, uneasy state. Mary steeled herself against the sympathy that leapt immediately into her mind. The remedy lay in his own hands. If he would only speak, all might be resolved. She thought of the slip of paper Mr. Collins had given her, with the line of Aristotle written upon it. "We make our own happiness," it had said. But how, she asked herself, was that to be achieved when there was so little candour in the world, such fear of confessing what one really felt? It pained her to admit it, but perhaps Mr. Ryder was right after all. Her mind was so absorbed with these thoughts that when the guide called out to them all, she started up, jolted back into reality.
"Ladies and gentlemen, we're very nearly at our destination."
He gestured towards a plateau a little way ahead.
"Ashridge is not 10 minutes' walk if we step out bravely."
In no time at all, they were there. As they stood, hands shading their eyes against the sunlight, triumphant on the little patch of ground they had laboured so mightily to reach, they fell silent, absorbing the full glory of their reward. It seemed as though the whole world was unfolded before them, hill after hill, undulating away to the distant horizon, one succeeding another, punctuated by the occasional silver flash of a lake. The guide pointed out the principal sights in one direction. There was Keswick, there Borrowdale and Bassenthwaite, before turning to show what lay in another, the mountains of Skiddaw, Helvellyn and Saddleback. Finally, with the aplomb of a magician revealing his best trick, he gestured towards the line of blue water on the horizon.
"And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the Solway Firth. Beyond lies Scotland."
Mary felt herself rooted to the spot. She could not draw her eyes away. So finally we behold the distant sea, just as we had hoped we would. Mr. Hayward had come to stand beside her. She did not turn to look at him, but continued to stare, entranced, into the landscape. "Yes," she replied, "and the mountains of Wastdale in tumult. The guide says they are in that direction." "Is it as magnificent as you expected it to be?" "I have never seen anything more beautiful. It is just as I pictured it, but somehow more so. Nature, it seems, far exceeds the power of my imagination in creating something so lovely." He moved a little closer to her. "I'm very glad," he continued softly, "that we were able to see it together." She did not know what to say. She could not subdue the anger that surged through her, and the warmth of his words, after so much coldness, only fanned the flames of her discontent. What did he mean by speaking so tenderly to her now, when he had done all he could to push her away with politeness? How was she to understand his behaviour? Part of her was bitterly hurt and wounded, but at the same time his nearness, the unsettling fact of his proximity, stirred her very deeply. His obvious unhappiness cut her to the quick. It took all her powers of self-control not to speak, to explain that nothing was as he thought, that all might be made well again if he wished it. Her heart told her this was the moment to do it. "Speak now, if you wish to take control of your destiny. If you truly wish to make your own happiness, speak now. This is your opportunity. There may never be another. Tell him what you feel. If he cannot do it, show him you can." She very nearly did so. She came so close that the words were half formed in her mind. But pride rose up within her, alongside fear and shame and resentment, and her courage failed her. Instead, she replied with a coolness intended to signal a detachment she was very far from feeling. "Yes, we can both congratulate ourselves on a magnificent achievement." There was a false indifference in her voice, which grated even on her own ears, but she would not relent, would not soften. "We have not spoken much to each other this morning."
"Nor yesterday, or the day before."
"It is true I've been somewhat distracted."
"I have noticed that."
She stood very still, upright, rigid. This was his opportunity to do what she had failed to do, to speak, explain, to redeem himself in her eyes. She clenched her fists tight with expectation. Another few seconds passed. Nothing. He had no more courage than she did herself. She would wait no longer for words of explanation that were plainly not to be said.
"Well," she said with a false, brittle brightness, "I find so much walking has made me hungry. I think I shall go and find out what the guide has brought for us to eat."
She could not mistake his surprise as she turned on her heel and left. His face fell, but she did not weaken and did not look back. Chapter 80. The guide had laid a clean cloth on a flat rock and spread upon it a loaf of bread, cheese, and a few apples. Caroline Bingley was reaching for some fruit when she saw Mary approaching. She offered no welcoming smile, but Mr. Ryder leapt up to greet her.
"If there's anything better than eating in the open air, I should like to know what it is.
May I help you to something, Miss Bennet?"
Mary took some cheese and an apple. She did not wish to spar with Miss Bingley, so politely took her leave and looked for a place to eat alone. She soon found a patch of dry grass with an accommodating rock to lean upon. She sat gratefully against it, took off her hat, and shook her head, as if trying to throw off the weight of her disappointment. Tiredness washed over her. She had no more energy to reflect on Mr. Hayward. For as long as she could remember, it had seemed as if she was a player in a game whose rules she did not understand, in which all the dice were weighted against her. She had done her best to learn what she was supposed to do, but somehow she always stumbled. As she looked into the distant hills, she realised how she longed to be free tall, to leave behind the posturing and falsity, the niceties and stratagems. Again, Mr. Ryder's words echoed in her mind. Why could not relations between men and women be stripped of misunderstanding? Why could they not be as natural and honest and simple as breathing? She hugged her knees and closed her eyes, feeling the sun on her neck. Her mind wandered, and in a few seconds she was asleep. She did not know what it was that woke her, but when she opened her eyes, she was astonished to see Mr. Ryder himself sitting not too far away from her, a blade of grass in his mouth, staring silently at the horizon. She started up, alarmed.
"Lord, sir, I must have fallen asleep. I hope it was not for long."
"Not more than 5 minutes," he replied, "or perhaps 10." She sat up, reached for her hat, and began to rise, but he held out his hand to stop her.
"I don't think there's any need to hurry. Everyone is occupied. Tom and the guide are discussing the landscape, and Miss Bingley is resting. Wait a moment and watch the view with me."
His quiet self-possession was soothing, and Mary could not find the spirit to protest. Together they watched the shadows cast by the clouds race across the green sides of the hills beyond them. In the far distance, it was hard to tell where the grey sea ended and the blue sky began. It was difficult to imagine anywhere more beautiful.
"I feel even I could write poetry here," murmured Mr. Ryder. "It would be impossible not to do so. This place could make poets of us all.
That sky would be enough to persuade anyone to pick up a pen."
"Even you, Miss Bennet? Can we expect some verses from you? On climbing Scafell, perhaps?"
"I hardly think my talents lie that way."
She saw a patch of daisies in the grass next to her, picked one, then another, and set to making a chain from them. He watched her indulgently.
"Excuse me if I say I doubt that. I'm sure you could do anything to which you truly set your mind."
"You are very kind, Mr. Ryder, but quite wrong, I'm afraid. I might be capable of setting a few lines down on paper. Any of us can do that. True poetic talent, however, is a rare thing. I know I do not possess it."
"That is what Tom says," observed Mr. Ryder. "He has often told me, usually after reading something I've written, that the desire to write poetry has no connection at all with the ability to do so. And that if you have no feeling for it, you had far better leave it alone."
"Yes, that sounds very like him," said Mary softly.
"Well, if I'm never to read any words of yours upon the countryside around us," continued Mr. Ryder, "perhaps you can simply tell me how it affects you. What do you think when you look at it?"
She gazed into the shimmering blue distance as if trying to fix it in her mind's eye.
"The first impression is of beauty, the colours, the light, the airiness. But the more you look, the more you understand it is the scale of what lies before us that is most startling. It is so large, so grand, and so majestic. And we are so small and insignificant in comparison."
"Those are my thoughts exactly," he cried. "It is magnificent, but it is also severe. It is quite indifferent to us, and we are irrelevant to it. All our petty concerns and worries, the silly little rules by which we live, all mean nothing in its presence."
"Looking at such a view, I understand why you might think that."
"I do think it, Miss Bennet. This landscape gives us a proper sense of perspective. It shows us our smallness in the great scheme of things. As these mountains understand it, in the blink of an eye, we and everything we have created will be gone."
"That's a gloomy thought, sir."
"On the contrary, I find it very exciting. To me, it has but one message. Do what you will and follow your heart, for we are all a very long time dead."
He plucked the grass from his mouth, threw it away, and leant a little closer to her.
"Our lives are so brief, and yet we spend so much of them obeying rules we did not make. The spirit of this place can't help but make me imagine what it would be like to be truly free, to speak and behave not as we thought was proper, but as we really wished to do, if we were honest enough to confess it."
She was a little shocked to hear her own recent thoughts refracted so clearly back to her.
If she were here, Mrs. Gardiner would tell you this is nothing but libertine's talk, a justification for every kind of licentiousness. Can you honestly tell me, and I beg you to be truthful now, that you have not felt something of what I describe? An impatience with the way things are ordered, particularly amongst men and women? Mary added the last daisy to the chain and placed it carefully in her lap. I cannot imagine why you should think that. I catch a glimpse of it every now and then in your expression before you cover it up in that way you have. Her self-possession faltered. You embarrass me, sir.
Only because I've seen something in you that I suspect you don't often admit, even to yourself.
You go too far. Then I shall stop. I don't wish to distress you. I will only say it seems plain to me that you long for happiness and freedom. But I'm afraid the first is only to be had by embracing the second. And it takes a great deal of courage to do that, especially for a woman.
He rose, brushing the dust from his coat.
For you, I think it would be a risk worth taking. You weren't made to live a dull, ordinary little life. You deserve more than that.
If I were fortunate enough to be with a man I loved, a little life would be neither dull nor ordinary. Mr. Ryder smiled. It is when you make remarks of that kind that I admire you the most. He took his leave as calmly as if they had been discussing idle pleasantries over the tea table, and ambled away to find the others. Mary did not follow him, but sat for a while alone. She stared into the hills as if seeking advice or reassurance there, but they had none to offer. And presently she too rose and went to join the rest of the party.
Chapter 81. When she arrived amongst them, only Mr. Haywood greeted her, his expression guarded, almost reproachful. Everyone else was staring intently into the sky.
"We are looking at the clouds," he explained.
"Will thinks he can see objects in them, ships, horses, and so on."
"They are there for those with the imagination to see them," declared Mr. Ryder. "Come, exercise your genius and tell me what you see."
"It's far too fanciful an occupation for Miss Bennet," replied Miss Bingley. "I beg you, do not feel obliged to join us in such a frivolous activity."
Mary ignored her and looked up towards the sky.
"I see shapes like the tops of trees, clustered together, a huge forest in the sky."
"Celestial woodlands," murmured Mr. Ryder, looking first at the sky and then at Mary. "I should like to walk amongst them."
"I cannot see it myself," said Mr. Haywood. "I see only clouds."
"It works if you surrender yourself to the conceit, Tom," urged Mr. Ryder. "I'm sure you'll see something extraordinary if you try."
"I think them pleasing enough as they are. When I see something naturally beautiful, I have no need to turn it into something it is not."
Mr. Ryder shrugged.
"Very well, I cannot compel you to be playful."
He shaded his eyes and looked once more into the sky.
"I think I see a ship of the line in full sail in the outline of that cloud. Can you see it too?"
Miss Bingley hurried to his side and immediately cried, "Yes!" She had it now. She could make out every detail, every rope of the rigging and billow of the sails. Her eagerness to please was so fervent that Mary felt ashamed for her and moved away. She found herself next to Mr. Haywood once more, and their eyes met, but neither of them seemed to know how to begin a conversation. Both were relieved when the guide approached them, his hat in his hand.
"I see you're looking at the weather. You're right to take notice. There's a change coming. We should think about going down."
The others wrenched their gaze away from the skies and turned to him, astonished.
"Go down?" asked Miss Bingley. "But we've only just got here."
"Yes, miss, I know, but nevertheless that's what we must do, and quickly, if you please."
"But the sky is so blue," protested Mr. Ryder. "And these clouds above us, they don't seem very threatening."
"No, sir, not those," replied the guide,
patient but determined.
"But look this way." on the horizon over the sea. That's where the rain is brewing up.
Mary could see nothing but the hazy blue line where the sky met the water.
I believe there is something there, said Mr. Hayward, concentrating hard. I can see a smudge of vapour or cloud out in the distance.
That's it, sir, said the guide. It's a rainstorm brewing. It's on its way. It might pass over quickly or it might pelt down. Whichever it is, we don't want to be caught in it up here.
Seems very hard to credit, persisted Mr. Ryder, when we're basking in sunshine and the air is as clear as a bell.
Yes, it's fine now, but it won't stay that way. That's not how the weather works on these fells. It comes out of nowhere and it moves very fast.
The guide looked away from Mr. Ryder to Mr. Hayward.
Come, gentlemen, we should go back now.
That seems good advice to me, said Mr. Hayward. Our guide knows these hills. We should do as he says. But Mr. Ryder was not to be persuaded.
Really, Tom, look around you. Do you honestly believe we're about to be inundated?
In matters of such importance, replied Mr. Hayward steadily, determined not to be provoked, I prefer to rely on expert knowledge rather than my instincts, which are unlikely to be either accurate or dependable. I suggest we all do the same.
As usual, we are obliged to be cautious and prudent, cried Mr. Ryder. It seems a pity to deny ourselves the pleasure we have just begun to enjoy after so long a climb.
I'm not sure what pleasure is to be had in finding ourselves soaked through, replied Mr. Hayward dryly.
Even if it does rain, Mr. Ryder went on, who is to say we should run away from it? A rainstorm in so wild a situation is likely to be a great natural phenomenon. Perhaps we should stay and witness it for ourselves.
He gestured to Mary.
Miss Bennet, I'm sure you have your copy of the guide with you. May I see it, please?
Mary produced the little book and passed it to him.
If I can't persuade you, Tom, perhaps you'll take more notice of your hero. Ah, here is the passage. Mr. Wordsworth tells us no traveller should grudge the price of a little inconvenience to witness the sight or sound of a storm coming on or clearing away. He says it is an incomparable experience.
I very much doubt he intended it to be enjoyed at the top of a great hill such as this one, remonstrated Mr. Hayward. Or that he intended ladies to be put to the inconvenience and misery it will doubtless involve.
I should not mind it, declared Miss Bingley. A little rain would be nothing to me. I will gladly stay, Mr. Ryder, in order to see something so remarkable.
You must see how foolish this is, Mr. Hayward replied, his exasperation growing ever more apparent. You surely understand the dangers that attend it. I beg you to reconsider. This is not a poem to be enjoyed in the warmth of your study. This is real. This is life.
There lies the difference between us, retorted Mr. Ryder,
equally passionate.
You want to keep the spirit of one away from the experience of the other. I, on the other hand, long to bring them together.
When he saw his arguments had made no impression at all upon his friend, Mr. Hayward turned to Mary. Miss Bennet, I appeal to you. Yours is a rational mind. Surely you appreciate the folly of all this. When he looked at her so directly, so urgent and imploring, Mary's first instinct was to support him. Every sensible impulse told her he was right, that she owed him her agreement. But then she was suddenly angry once more, and the strength of her feelings put an end to all considered judgment. He would not explain the reasons for his withdrawal from her, but imagined he could still call upon her when he required endorsement for his views. Then she was of service to him. Then she could be depended upon to be the voice of dullness and restraint. Well, she should do so no more. She was tired of passing judgment, of urging others more lively than herself back to the narrow path of duty. She would not agree with Mr. Hayward, even though every fibre of her understanding told her to do so. For once, her heart would rule her head. She would throw off her usual restraint and surrender to the thrill of the unknown and the unpredictable. She should not be herself at all.
I think I should like to see the amazing sight Mr. Wordsworth describes. It seems a great pity to have come so far and to leave just as something extraordinary is about to happen.
That is exactly how I see it, exclaimed Mr. Ryder. We shall embrace whatever nature is pleased to exhibit to us.
Mr. Hayward looked at Mary as though he could not believe what she had said, but she was determined not to falter. "We will never have the chance to see anything like this again," she continued. "Perhaps we could just stay long enough to see the storm come towards us and begin our descent before it arrives. Then we might outwalk the worst of it, without having missed the remarkable scenes Mr. Wordsworth describes." Mr. Ryder thought this was an excellent plan, and went to inform their guide, who had absented himself from their circle once their disagreements began to grow lively. Miss Bingley hurried along in his wake, pausing only to direct towards Mary a glance which was both imperious and disdainful. Then Mary and Mr. Hayward were left alone. "Mary," he said, speaking so low that she struggled to hear him, "what are you doing? You cannot outwalk a storm. You must know that." "I am not sure what I know or do not know. I find it hard to say any more what is true and what is false."
"I don't understand you."
"I'm tired of trying to make sense of things, to understand behaviours that seem to have no rational cause. I have given up on thinking for a while. All I want to do just now is to feel."
"This is not like you at all."
"I should very much hope not. I'm tired of my old character, and am resolved to try on a new one. Perhaps that will bring me more in the way of happiness and satisfaction."
"I am sorry to hear it. I was very fond of the old Mary."
He stepped towards her, but she moved away. "I shall be sure and tell her that. I think she often wondered what your true feelings were, so she will no doubt be pleased to know." He did not reply, but stood silent, his whole person a picture of distress. He took off his hat and ran his fingers angrily through his hair, but still he said nothing. The only sound to be heard was that of the guide arguing with Mr. Ryder, clearly incredulous at what he had proposed.
"It seems I must leave you," said Mr. Hayward stiffly. "I must explain to our guide why, when we hired him for his experience and promised to be guided by it, we have decided on the flimsiest and most ridiculous grounds to ignore his advice."
Mary watched him join the two men and do his best to placate the angry, disbelieving guide. She saw him wave Mr. Ryder away, watched as he spoke quietly to the guide, put his hand in his pocket, drew out what was plainly cash, and passed it to the aggrieved man, talking all the while until the guide grew calmer. Mary swallowed hard. She hoped she had not been as foolish as her intellect now whispered to her that she had.
Chapter 82. The storm was not long in making itself felt. The vapour on the distant horizon coalesced into clouds, great columns of grey that blotted out the sun and shadowed the hilltops as they raced across the sky. The peaks before them were first lit up and then plunged into darkness, their green hillsides a shifting patchwork of colour. A curtain of dark rain shimmered in the distance, a rumble of thunder echoed in the far-off valleys. At first, Mary was elated. Mr. Wordsworth had been right, she thought. This was indeed a thing worth seeing. She stood transfixed by the boiling landscape when Mr. Ryder joined her, just as delighted by the prospect before them. "Isn't this superb? The mighty power of nature in action. This is why we came here." He turned to face her, his expression exuberant, and without warning, something of his passion leapt into her own heart. Suddenly, she was conscious of nothing but the most acute sensations. Fear and joy mixed together, a sense of awe and wonderment that took her breath away. She did not know what it was or how to describe it, but as she stared into the drama unfolding in front of her, she felt both great and small at the same time, connected to the world in a way she had never been before, yet also marvellously and uniquely herself. She closed her eyes and let the feeling pass over her, giving herself up to it, until she thought there was nothing to her but sensation. It was perhaps a minute before the extreme intensity of her emotion began to diminish. She breathed out,
opened her eyes and was still again. Before she came to the lakes, she had read a great deal about the sublime, sights so extraordinary they could not be adequately described, only felt and experienced. She had never expected to feel for herself such an extraordinary consummation. Her spirit was surely too stolid, too plain to achieve anything of that kind. Now she knew that was not so, and a wave of gratitude swept over her. Then the rain hit them. It was quite unlike the gentle showers Mary knew from Hertfordshire. It poured down in a great deluge, soaking her hat, drenching her clothes, and jolting her out of her trance. It fell with such force that it pricked her eyes. She stood dazed until she saw Mr. Hayward walking towards her, the guide following in his wake. "Miss Bennet, we must leave now. This is no longer a subject for discussion. Miss Bingley, come with us, quickly, if you please. Either you walk down in our company, Will, or you must make your way alone. We shall wait no longer." His tone forbade any contradiction. Mary, shaken now, tried to wipe the rain from her face and readied herself to depart. Miss Bingley, too, obeyed with neither a sharp aside nor a withering look, and even Mr. Ryder tore himself away from the view and followed. For the first 20 minutes, they walked as fast as the path allowed, making their way down from the ridge to the more open country below. It had been hard climbing up, but, as Mary soon discovered, it was no easier to descend. The rain drove puddles into the saturated ground, and it required all her concentration to pick her way through the stones that littered the route, their surfaces slippery in the mud. Their guide constantly urged them to make haste, insisting they must move faster if they were not to be drowned before they reached the bottom. But soon even he could see that the ladies in their soaked skirts and sodden hats needed a moment to catch their breath before hurrying on as best they could.
"We might find some shelter over there," he shouted,
pointing towards an untidy group of large boulders a short way off the path.
"If we settle in the lee of these rocks for a while, we might avoid the worst of it."
They hurried as best they could towards the stones, and were soon huddled against them, Mr. Hayward shepherding Mary and Miss Bingley into the space which offered the most protection. The guide pulled the hood of his coat over his head, his attitude one of resentful dejection. Only Mr. Ryder's spirits seemed unaffected by their situation.
"I shall walk back to the path for a moment and look into the valley. The storm must be at the height of its vigour now. I should like to glimpse it, if I can."
"Is that wise?"
asked Miss Bingley.
"You will be drenched."
"I can hardly get any wetter than I am already," said Mr. Ryder, lightly. "As there is no part of me not thoroughly soaked, I may as well take advantage of the fact."
Miss Bingley smiled weakly as he strode away, but Mr. Hayward said nothing. He had spoken no more than was absolutely required since they had begun their descent. Mary could see that he was very angry. As she considered their exposed and bedraggled state, as she imagined the difficulties that must await them as they attempted to get down, she could not deny his frustration was justified. His assessment of their situation had been correct, but he had not been listened to, and she had been one of those who had spoken against him. "We stayed too long on the ridge," she ventured quietly. "I see that now. We should have left earlier."
"You say that as though this is our fault," replied Miss Bingley. "But how are we to know what would happen? We have been unlucky, but cannot reproach ourselves for it."
She looked defiantly at Mr. Hayward, who met her eye steadily. "I'm afraid I disagree," he said sharply. "We were offered very clear advice, but chose to disregard it."
"It sounds as though you blame Mr. Ryder, sir."
"Everyone who agreed to ignore our guide bears some responsibility for our situation, and I do not exempt myself from criticism. I should have argued harder for us to leave, demanded we go when it was right to do so." Mary's earlier elation had been washed away by the rain. As she watched rivulets of water running swiftly through a little gully between the stones, she felt both mortified and ashamed. She stole a glance at Mr. Hayward, who stood alone looking into the rain. Despite all that had passed between them, she could not bear that he should think ill of her. The anger and the indignation she felt earlier had ebbed away, replaced by a dull ache of sadness and regret.
It was painful enough to think that she might have lost his affection, but to imagine that she had also forfeited his respect was almost too much to bear. When they were back at the inn, she must find a way to explain her behaviour on the ridge, to try and make him understand how provoked and wounded she had been by his own hurtful actions, and beg him to account for them if he could. This time, she told herself, she would not be deflected, but would find out the truth of how things really stood between them. It was half an hour before the sky started to lighten and the rain began to fall with slightly less intensity. All the walkers were now soaked through. Mary's coat and dress clung to her, cold, wet, and heavy. Her hat dripped, her boots leaked. There was no part of her that was not wet through. When the guide announced that he thought the worst was over, she felt only a little relief. She knew they must walk down in this miserable condition and dreaded the prospect. But she stood up bravely, resolved to put one foot in front of the other for as long as she was capable of making the effort. They walked in a gloomy, silent procession, the guide in front leading them towards the least demanding route. Mr. Ryder followed behind, accompanied by Miss Bingley. She had seized the opportunity presented by the perilous conditions to attach herself firmly to his arm, and clearly did not intend to relinquish it until they were on steady ground once more. Mr. Ryder did not seem to mind. He had achieved one of the great wishes of his heart and was satisfied. He had contemplated the natural world in all its majesty, and, at least until another great wish suggested itself, was content. He smiled encouragingly at Mary every now and then, but Miss Bingley's grip was tenacious, and he did not try too hard to escape from it. Mary kept a little apart from Mr. Hayward. She did not feel able to begin her explanations in such circumstances, and did not see how she could say anything else until she had done so. With every step, she grew more exhausted and unhappy, until the discomfort she felt in both mind and body were pretty equally matched. Then she missed her footing. Her boot slid in the mud, and she fell slowly but irrevocably onto her knees. She caught her breath from shock and surprise, but before she could give way to tears, she felt Mr. Hayward take her hand. He raised her up firmly but gently and brushed the worst of the dirt from her dress. "Are you hurt? Have you any pain?"
No, I don't think so. A little bump on my knee, nothing worse."
"Can you move it?"
She tried, succeeded, and nodded mutely. He took her arm and tucked it carefully within his own. "No protests, please. This is the best way to get you safely down." She was about to speak, but thought if she did, she would never stop. This was not the moment for that conversation. It was enough simply to accept his help, to allow him to guide her through the pitfalls along the path. "Careful here, step a little higher now. Watch for that sharp stone," as they made their slow way down. They had been walking for some time when she thought she heard shouting from further down the hill. The guide heard it too and rushed forward, hollering a reply.
"I think that must be help," said Mr. Hayward, "or at least I hope it is."
Mary sighed with relief. The calls grew louder as their deliverers came nearer and nearer, but the drizzle was still so thick and so low that it was another 10 minutes before their rescuers actually appeared out of the mist. The innkeeper was at the front of the little band, followed closely by an anxious Mr. Gardner, with two servants each, leading a stout little pony on a rein.
"Mary, thank God!"
Mr. Gardner hurried towards her with such transparent concern that even in her wet and sorry state, Mary could not help but raise a weak smile.
"Oh, Uncle, it is very good to see you."
"I cannot tell you how pleased I am to see you unhurt. You are unhurt, I presume."
"I twisted my knee a little, but it doesn't amount to anything. Mr. Hayward helped me down. He has been so kind."
Mr. Gardner clasped Mr. Hayward's hand.
"Well done, Tom. Well done. I'd have expected nothing less from you."
Mr. Gardner turned back to Mary.
"Your poor aunt has been beside herself since the rain came on so strongly. She would not rest until we set out to find you."
He chatted away, aghast at the mud. exclaiming at their wet clothes, before seating Mary carefully upon one of the little ponies, whilst Miss Bingley was mounted upon the other. The innkeeper offered Mr. Ryder and Mr. Hayward what Mary supposed was brandy from a small flask, but she was quite satisfied with the sweet cold tea he provided for the ladies. Even Mr. Ryder seemed ready to be delivered from the storm, clearly looking forward to the more down-to-earth pleasures of a dry coat and a roaring fire. Mary was not quite sure exactly when Mr. Hayward had melted away from her side. He did not bid her goodbye. She watched him deep in conversation with her uncle, no doubt explaining to him the circumstances that had brought about their plight. Although Mary doubted he would tell him the whole story, it was impossible to imagine him placing the blame upon others. It was not in his character to behave so meanly. Their arrival at the inn threw the household into uproar. Water was heated up for baths, dirty clothes bundled away for washing, beds warmed and fires lit. Mrs. Gardiner wrung her hands, desperately anxious lest Mary should catch cold from her soaking. Even Miss Bingley was swept up in the ferociousness of her concern, compelled to submit to her insistence that both young women take themselves immediately to bed and stay there for as long as they could be made to do so. In truth, Mary did not need a great deal of persuasion. She was exhausted and fell gratefully into the sheets. Her only regret was that she had not had a chance to talk to Mr. Hayward before she was hurried upstairs. Her last thought, before sleep overwhelmed her, was that tomorrow she should seek him out in some private place and attempt the conversation she had failed to have on the Fell. Tomorrow, she thought, as she fell asleep, tomorrow she would speak to him, come what may. Chapter 83. When Mary woke, she could tell by the position of the sunlight on the bedroom wall that it was long past her usual time of rising. She washed, dressed briskly, and rushed downstairs, where she found only her aunt and Mr. Ryder still at the breakfast table. Mrs. Gardiner sprang up and looked keenly into Mary's face, her hand reaching out swiftly to touch her brow.
"Thank God there's no fever, and you look very well rested."
"Yes, thank you, I feel entirely myself."
"I am very relieved, and you'll be pleased to hear that Miss Bingley has also suffered no ill effects."
"She's absent only because she's taking her breakfast in bed," said Mr. Ryder. "All in all, I think we may count our excursion a success. A great natural event seen at close quarters, and all of us alive to tell the tale."
"I am not yet ready to find your misadventure a joke, Mr. Ryder," replied Mrs. Gardiner severely. "I should not like to be in such a state of anxiety again as I was yesterday afternoon."
Mr. Ryder apologised, begging Mrs. Gardiner's pardon, but he smiled at Mary from under his penitent brow. She busied herself with the tea things, declining to meet his eye. She was not to be distracted from the only object of importance that morning, that of seeking out Mr. Hayward and speaking to him with all the honesty and frankness of which she was capable.
"Are the other gentlemen already out?" she asked. "They must have left very early." "Mr. Gardiner is certainly gone," replied her aunt. "Once he knew you were quite well, he took himself to the lake with his rod. Mr. and Mrs. Hurst have gone to Grasmere Village. I have not yet seen Mr. Hayward."
"Tom often takes a walk before breakfast," said Mr. Ryder. "No doubt he will appear at any moment demanding strong coffee."
Again he tried to catch Mary's eye, and again she applied herself to her tea. She thought she would stay close to the inn for the rest of the morning, waiting for Mr. Hayward to return. She was so absorbed in thinking what she should say to him that she hardly noticed as the innkeeper approached their table. He handed Mrs. Gardiner a letter, which she read and passed wordlessly to Mary. "My dear Mrs. Gardiner, it is with much regret that I must tell you I have been summoned back to London to attend to some urgent business. I am sure you will understand nothing but the most pressing obligation would have persuaded me to leave in so hurried a manner. It is extremely distressing to me to be obliged to go without saying a proper goodbye, which seems small recompense for your prodigious kindness in having me with you over the last few weeks. I intend, once my business is concluded, to take this opportunity to visit my mother in Hampshire and stay there for a while. I hope at some later date to see you once again in Gracechurch Street, but until then I hope I can presume on your generosity to bid farewell on my behalf to Mr. Gardiner, Mr. Ryder, and the rest of our party, assuring them that only the need to catch the Keswick fly prevents me writing to each in person. I beg to be remembered to Miss Bennet. Yours in haste, Thomas Heywood. Chapter 84. The spirits of the holiday party never properly recovered from Mr. Heywood's sudden departure. His absence was keenly felt. He was much lamented by the Gardiners, although Mrs. Gardiner took care not to be overly extravagant in her regrets. She was too astute not to perceive that some breach or misunderstanding had occurred between him and her niece, and did not doubt it was that which had led to Mr. Heywood's leaving them, but she had no wish to add to Mary's obvious unhappiness, and therefore gave no direct hint of her suspicions. Mr. Ryder seemed oblivious of such a possibility, although whether that was by design or innocence was impossible to say. His manner was as easy and as open as ever, with nothing to suggest he thought of his friend with anything other than sympathy for his situation and slight incredulity at his bearing it so well. "Tom has always been of a very conscientious turn of mind," he declared as they sat around the inn's dinner table a few nights later. "He is a prodigious worker. It is not in his character to leave anything undone or to throw off a responsibility he believes is his."
"I'm glad to hear it," observed Mr. Gardiner firmly. "Such an attitude is essential in business, and I imagine it is the same in the professions. There are times when the demands of one's occupation must take precedence over private pleasures."
"As I have cause to know," murmured Mrs. Gardiner.
"Come, my dear," her husband replied. "You understand how it is. Sometimes a man has no choice but to attend to such matters, however much he may wish it was not so."
"It must be very unpleasant to be at everyone's beck and call," said Miss Bingley smoothly. "Of all the many aggravations involved in pursuing a trade, the knowledge that one is not one's own master must be the most trying."
She favoured the table with a brilliant, unapologetic smile, whilst everyone around it silently absorbed the sting of her remark. Mr. Gardiner frowned. Mrs. Gardiner was clearly taken aback at such a very obvious snub. But Mary was outraged. She had learned to ignore Miss Bingley's jibes when they were directed towards her, but she could not bear to hear them aimed at those she loved.
"I imagine you must have seen many such occasions yourself at first hand," she remarked, with a bland calmness quite equal to that of Miss Bingley. "As your own father was deeply engaged in business, he must often have been called upon to subordinate his wishes to the requirements of his trade." It was a moment before Miss Bingley collected herself sufficiently to reply,
"I cannot recall examples of that kind," she said, looking a little agitated as she applied herself intently to buttering her bread. "My father had been long removed from any such necessities by the time I was old enough to know about them."
She quickly recovered her usual assurance, but Mary knew, too, that in so publicly reminding her of her origins, she had only intensified the lady's hatred for her, that her remark would not be forgotten, and that she should eventually pay for it in some way she could not yet imagine. But she did not care. She was glad she had spoken. When dinner was over and the others left the table, Mary remained brooding once more over the question of Mr. Heywood's departure. She had thought of nothing else since he left, and had quickly arrived at conclusions identical to those of her aunt. She was convinced that she herself was the reason he was gone. She knew he had been bitterly disappointed by her refusal to take his part during the argument on Scafell, and she was painfully aware her ill-judged support for Mr. Ryder on the ridge had both shocked and hurt him. But had that really been enough to drive him away? She did not know what to think. She could not persuade herself he was entirely indifferent to her, his leaving as he had, rushing away at dawn with no polite goodbyes or apologetic farewells, was not the act of a man who did not care. On the contrary, it suggested passions strongly and deeply felt. She supposed he might still have been driven by the jealousy she thought she had detected. But how was that to be reconciled with the marked tenderness and consideration he had shown her on their descent down the fell? The careful concern he had displayed for her then did not suggest either resentment or dislike. He could not have been more kind, more solicitous about her safety. But at this, she felt herself about to cry and did not allow herself to think any more of his steadying arm linked so firmly with her own. Why had he simply not opened his heart to her then and there, explaining the truth of what he felt? If he had spoken, she would not have hesitated to have given him the answer she still believed would have pleased him. But instead, he had left with nothing explained, abandoning her to make what little sense she could of his behaviour. What could he have meant by it? She thought of nothing else, but as day followed day, she was no closer to arriving at a conclusion, no matter how many hours she spent considering it. She did everything in her power to hide her mounting unhappiness from those around her. She refused to be drawn by Miss Bingley's frequent speculations on the probable reasons for Mr. Hayward's departure, greeting them with an expression of studied indifference that revealed nothing of her inner misery. She declined Mr. Ryder's frequent invitations to take the air with him, knowing she would be utterly unable to match his air of cheerful unconcern. She feared she might capitulate to recrimination or anger if Mr. Hayward's name was mentioned, and she knew neither would bring her any relief. It made no sense, Mary told herself, to blame Mr. Ryder for what had happened. He had never disguised the principles by which he lived. She could hardly complain when he acted upon them, as he had done on Scafell. It had been her choice to decide whether to follow his example or not, and now she must deal with the consequences of her judgment. But when she watched him go about his business, his affability untouched by any sense of guilt or regret, she could not entirely suppress her resentment. He had followed his inclinations and had paid no price at all for doing so, whilst she was left mired in misery and regret. So no, she would not walk down the hill with him, or even take a short stroll around the inn. Instead, she wrapped herself in politeness and found 1,000 civil ways of refusing him. It was much harder to disguise what she felt in the presence of her uncle and aunt. Mary knew they were concerned about her. She had several times come upon them deep in discussions, which they broke off as soon as she arrived, the subject of which was only too plain to them all. Only once did her aunt attempt to broach it directly, asking Mary if she did not think Tom's leaving them so suddenly had been most out of character. But when Mary showed herself disinclined to speak on a subject which was so painful to her, her aunt did not press her. Mary was grateful for Mrs. Gardiner's discretion, and on more than one occasion she was tempted to confide everything to her, but for all her aunt's kindness, Mary knew it would do no good. The only conversation which could relieve her distress was one between herself and Mr. Hayward. But that could only happen if they returned to London. So when Mr. Gardiner finally suggested it was perhaps time for them to go home, Mary was obliged to conceal her eagerness to do so, lest it seem she was ungrateful for having been brought on holiday at all. She was not the only one to feel their stay at the Lakes had come to an end. Everyone agreed it was time to leave, and soon all was in readiness for their departure. Mr. Ryder's party was the first to go. Miss Bingley was coolly civil as she climbed into the carriage, clearly hoping she would not be forced into Miss Bennet's unwelcome company again. In contrast, Mr. Ryder was keen to ensure they would meet again soon once back in London. "I very much hope to see you in town, Miss Bennet. Perhaps we could make up a party and return to Vauxhall. I should be very happy to arrange it, if you say the word." "It is very kind of you, but I don't intend to go abroad too much when we return. I think I shall stay close at home for a while."
"Then perhaps I may come and visit you there. We could read a little poetry together."
"Of course, if that would please you." It was not the most enthusiastic invitation, but Mr. Ryder was satisfied. He sprang into the carriage, the driver cracked his whip, and as Mary watched them disappear, it occurred to her she had been right to have found their unexpected arrival in the Lakes unsettling. They had brought nothing with them but trouble. Part 4. Chapter 85. It took 2 days to get to the Bingleys' house and retrieve the children, and another 2 to reach London. During these long hours, Mary thought of little else but Mr. Hayward. She missed him more than she could say, and could not quite believe the situation in which she found herself. Time and time again, she rehearsed the circumstances which had divided them, trying to find an explanation for what had happened, but nothing satisfied her. To have returned home, for thus she now considered her aunt and uncle's house, with matters so dreadfully unresolved, was agony. She did not think she could bear the pain of unknowing, but what was she to do? She was powerless. Even if she wished to, she could not act. It was impossible for her to call upon him. He was not in London. But even if he had been in town, it would have been unthinkable. Respectable women did not visit the houses of single young men uninvited. Nor could she write. She supposed she might ask Mrs. Gardiner for his family's address in Hampshire, but knew her aunt would, in all probability, refuse to give it to her. She could not begin a correspondence with him. Every rule of custom and delicacy forbade it. There was nothing to be done but wait. Wait to see what he would do. The world offered her no other choice. Once back at Gracechurch Street, she tried to make the long days bearable. She took out her books and tried to study, but concentration eluded her, and she put them away. She read stories with the little gardeners and heard the lessons of the older children. She sat patiently next to the piano as the girls practised their scales and arpeggios, encouraging them gently as they stumbled through a few simple airs. She did not play herself. She had not the spirit for it. She attempted to help Mrs. Gardiner in her household tasks, volunteering to inspect the linen cupboards, but in her distraction she confused the good sheets with those needing repair, and the whole business of sorting and assessing had to be done again. She volunteered to wash the best china, the cups and saucers too fine to be entrusted to servants, but a wet plate slid out of her inattentive hands and broke into pieces on the floor. She looked so distraught that her aunt did not have the heart to scold her. But Mrs. Gardiner did not think her household valuables would survive much more of her niece's assistance, and urged her to put on her coat and go out for a walk. Obediently, Mary did so. But the lively city streets no longer excited her as they once had. The shop windows that had once entranced her seemed familiar, even tawdry. The roads were dirty, the pavement crowded. Everyone was in a hurry. She was jostled and pushed. The one sight she longed to see was that of Mr. Hayward in the long brown coat he had worn on the Fells, on his way to call at Gracechurch Street. But no matter how fervently she hoped for it, there was no sign of him. Mary had been back in London over a week when she returned back home one afternoon, dusty and discouraged from yet another dutiful expedition. As she walked into the hall, she saw one of the servants disappearing towards the cloakroom with a gentleman's coat draped over his arm. She did not stop to ask who the visitor was, but raced up the stairs to the drawing-room. Her heart was in her mouth as she reached the door, but when she opened the door, it was not Mr. Hayward who rose, delighted, eager to greet her. It was his friend, Mr. Ryder.
"My dear Miss Bennet, how very pleased I am to see you. I have come to pay my respects. I would have come sooner, but I have been down in Kent, yet more family business to attend to, although I hope all that is finished now."
"Mr. Ryder, I was not expecting you. I hope I have not come upon you at an inconvenient time, as so often seems to be my fate."
Mary recovered her composure enough to invite him to sit down. She called for tea, and by the time it arrived, she felt tolerably in command of herself.
"I hope your time in Kent went off well, sir. I have never been there. Is it a beautiful place?"
"It is pleasant enough. Fields and orchards and sheep, you know, the sort of thing. Not to be compared to the beauty of the lakes, of course." He began to talk fondly of the great grey mountains and bright blue skies they had so recently enjoyed, and she slowly felt herself more at ease. He did not seem to require much in reply except an occasional smile of reminiscence or assent. The conversation went on well enough, with only the occasional question from her, which she found suited her mood admirably. "Should you like to return there?" she ventured politely.
To a different part of the lakes, perhaps. To tell the truth, Miss Bennet, the next time I travel, I'm resolved to go abroad, to Italy, if I can. If the Westmoreland Fells had such an effect upon us, imagine the impact of the Alps. I am not sure I have much appetite for mountains any more. Our walk down Scafell in the storm seems to have cured me of any desire to climb another. Mr. Ryder laughed politely. It was plain he did not consider their saturated, struggling descent worthy of further remark. And what of you, Miss Bennet? How have you been occupying yourself since our return? What are you reading at present? I'm ashamed to say I have nothing particular about me at the moment. I seem to have lost the application a serious book requires.
That sounds most unlike you. But I have the perfect solution. What you require is a review. They are the very thing for a distracted mind. You can read what you like and ignore the rest, picking through its articles as if you're looking for the ripest pear in the bowl. Let me bring you one. Which do you prefer, the Edinburgh or the Quarterly?
Mr. Hayward used to give me the Edinburgh sometimes, but he said its judgments were not entirely to be trusted.
That's because its reviewers have not always been kind to his adored Wordsworth. You know how loyal he is once he has found something to love.
Mary busied herself putting the lid back on the sugar bowl. Have you seen him since we returned to London?
I have not, he replied. I imagine he is still with his family. It will come as no surprise to you to hear that he is a very dutiful son.
Mr. Ryder had nothing more to say about his friend's whereabouts, nor could he be prevailed upon to suggest when he might be seen amongst them again, and, perhaps feeling this subject had been thoroughly exhausted, announced shortly afterwards that he was obliged to take his leave.
"But I have an appointment with my bankers. Oh, it's nothing but business and more business for me lately, which has made even this short interlude feel like a snatched pleasure, as though I've been let off my lessons, as it were."
He downed the last of his tea with a single swift gesture and stood up, entirely at his ease in Mrs. Gardiner's drawing-room.
"I shall bring you copies of both the Edinburgh and Quarterly reviews. You can decide for yourself which you like best. It will be an excellent excuse for me to call again."
A few days later, he returned, bearing the promised copies of the magazines. Of course, it was necessary to offer him tea, during which he declared his intention of returning again to hear what Mary made of them. Soon he was almost as regular a presence in the Gracechurch Street drawing-room as his friend had once been.
"You must have a great deal of time to call your own," observed Mrs. Gardiner one afternoon a week later, when Mr. Ryder was once more to be found in her drawing-room drinking her tea and eating her cakes.
"Of course we are always glad to see you. What should we do with our currant tarts otherwise? But you seem somewhat solitary at present. What of Miss Bingley? I have not seen her for a while."
"She is visiting her brother, but returns shortly, I think."
"And is there any news of Mr. Hayward? We've heard nothing from him since we left the lakes."
Mr. Ryder flicked a few crumbs from his waistcoat.
"No, not a line. But I expect we will hear from him soon. It isn't like Tom to stay silent for long."
Mary placed her hands in her lap, hoping to convey the impression of a serenity she did not feel. Mr. Ryder's company had only made her miss his friend more. His visits sharpened her loss, magnifying her sense of abandonment. The better she came to know Mr. Ryder, the more she longed for Mr. Hayward. It was not that Mr. Ryder's company was distasteful. She was used to him now. She knew how to appreciate his better qualities, and his less admirable traits no longer disturbed her as they had once done. Even his self-absorption no longer bothered her. After a while, there was something restful in it. His reluctance to make moral judgments came to seem equally soothing. It gave him an easy tolerance of the shortcomings of others, and also of himself. He preferred things to be agreeable rather than not, but, Mary suspected, did not in truth feel anything particularly strongly. He craved sensation, but she doubted he was a man governed by profound and lasting passions. Those would involve rather too much trouble. His feelings were like jam spread thinly on bread and butter, sweet, all-encompassing, and readily available, but not penetrating very deeply. The contrast with Mr. Hayward could not have been more stark.
His affection, she supposed, would be like a long-simmered beef stock, a great while in the making, but strong and rich and unmistakably flavoured. It amused her when she thought how ridiculous a simile this was, yet even as she smiled inwardly to herself, she felt a sharp pang of regret. She missed his passionate enthusiasms, which sat so unexpectedly with his otherwise steady temper. She missed his sharp mind and ready wit. She missed the warmth of his smile, the look of amusement in his glance as he caught her eye across the dinner table. She had hoped that as the days passed into weeks, she would have begun to miss him less, but this had not been so. If anything, the opposite was true.
"Have you written to Mr. Hayward, sir? Perhaps he needs a little encouragement to begin upon a correspondence."
"I am not a great writer of letters, I'm afraid. No, in Tom's case, there is nothing to be done but wait. He is determined to try our patience, but we are equal to it. He will write when he is ready to do so, and not a minute before."
Mary nodded at Mr. Ryder's words with every appearance of taking them to heart, but each day she looked for a letter from Mr. Hayward, and each day she was disappointed. When the post arrived, she sorted through it with as much appearance of unconcern as she could muster, and when she found nothing there for her, put it back on the tray with an equally unconvincing display of indifference. She did this for nearly 3 weeks, yet every morning she hoped against hope that today would be the day his letter finally appeared. So one morning, when her aunt approached her as she sat at the piano with her niece, ready to begin their practice, the first thing Mary noticed was the envelope she held in her hand.
"I have some most unexpected news," announced Mrs. Gardiner. "We are to have a visitor, it seems. Your mother is coming, Mary. She expects to arrive next week."